So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some Higgs field spaces and interaction field spaces in general, in terms of how we're thinking, trying to interface with collider physics data. And we're trying to interface with collider physics data that's rapidly improving in terms of the magnitude of the data and the precision of the measurements. And it's forcing us, in order to do the calculations that need to be done to interpret the data, to actually start to think geometrically, which is, I think, the most interesting thing for this audience. So this is really data-driven at the end of the day. And what I want to show you and try and get across to you is some cool stuff that we already understand and how it's cleaned up stuff that was confusing to us, but how it also has led us right up to the point where we don't understand some things. And I suspect if we don't understand things about geometry, this audience is the audience to say, hey, how does this work in terms of your generalized field theories that you've thought about? And maybe you'll know the answer to some of the outstanding questions, and there'll be a useful cross-communication, hopefully, involving that sort of thing going forward. So what I'm showing you here, some pictures, is a little smattering of things that have been developed from various groups. You'll see some of this stuff as we go through. But this diagonal here is stuff that was coming out of the Copenhagen group involving the standard model EFT, which you'll see that application of this geometric thinking a lot in this talk, because it's actually interfacing with data at LHC. This is from the group in Santa Barbara of a couple weeks ago, where they're trying to think about derivative field redefinitions. And we'll get to that at the end, I hope. And this is a nice paper that was written by Anish Manohar and other collaborators from San Diego, where they were thinking about just the first term there in terms of the pure scalar sort of metric and that sort of thing. So we'll get to these various things going through, and we'll see how far we get. And I hope to get us to the point of ignorance. So then at some point, if I succeed, we'll get to the point where you'll ask a question and I'll say, I don't know. And then we'll stop. And hopefully that'll be interesting. Okay, so what are we doing here? So I'm going to give I'm going to try and use the blackboard as well as use the slides here to try and make things clear to you and try and extrapolate on some of the points. So, So let me try and expand upon this point and try and make this clear, okay? And we're going to do a lot of reasoning by analogy. Okay, so why are we thinking of these field spaces? Why are we thinking of these field spaces at all? And it's basically because what we're doing is we're basically calculating a set of observables, and we're then predicting another set of observables, and we have some symmetry transformation properties that the theory is invariant under. So what we're doing when we're interfacing with this collider data is we're doing an S matrix in and out states. And we know that if we can get our generating Green's functions, and we have an LSE procedure, we can get to the S matrix, and we can actually just calculate a whole bunch of observables. And we want to stress test something like the standard model or the standard model with higher dimensional operators. And so when we're doing that, we want to have a generating functional that allows us to calculate these connected Green's functions. And as you know, it's integrated over in the path integral of the field variables, and we have a function of the fields, and then some sources. And so the usual way we think about things is we usually think it's good enough to usually think in terms of D less than or equal to 4. Okay, so if we're thinking about dimension less than or equal to 4 Lagrangians and interactions, then the symmetry transformations that we're interested in terms of what controls what appears in the Lagrangian, what we write down, are usually like gauge transformations, right? So a simple set of transformations that we know how to think about. And the useful analogy I'm going to exploit here is that we basically have these transformations, and then we're going to do a more general class of transformations, the field redefinitions in general. And so we have this set of transformations for the gauge field. And sorry, I'm going into this. And for a scalar field. And let me know if you can't read this or if it's not clear. I'm getting there. I'm just extrapolating out. I'm going to get to this story. We're just getting to there. I'm reasoning this out. Okay, so just give me a second. And we're going to define this connection as well, divided by 2. Okay, so we just have gauge transformations. Our gauge transformations leave our action invariant. And then we have a symmetry relationship between a set of observables that we want to basically measure, and then another set of observables we want to predict. And the important point of using gauge transformations and gauge fixing is if you use background field gauge fixing so you don't disturb the unbroken background field gauge symmetries, then you know what you write down in terms of your Lagrangian, in terms of counterterms, and basically organizes your thinking in terms of what's the useful objects in the field theory to think about. Okay, so that's, you know that. And what we're going to do is we're going to basically look at another set of transformations that are general field redefinitions, which are related to going beyond renormalizable theories and effective field theories in general.
Was there a delta alpha there?
Sorry?
Is it delta phi A? Was it delta alpha A?
The
second formula.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, alpha. Yes. So, thank you. So this general set of transformations we're going to think about going beyond these is just field redefinitions of this form. So if you start to think about D not being limited to less than or equal to 4, so D anything, then you can basically take a field and transform it as a field, a composite operator form, some cutoff scale in the EFT. You can do this with some other composite operator forms at higher orders. And these sorts of transformations also, when you integrate over the field variables, we leave the observables invariant under those transformations. And so we expect there to be something in the field theory that reflects that invariance, right? The way we think about things should reflect that field redefinition invariance. So that's the field space geometries that we're going to be talking about, okay? So in the case of the specific example of the standard model EFT, those transformations basically start you thinking about generalizations of the kinetic terms with open indices in terms of these things which we're going to be called field space interaction metrics, okay? So what you should do in terms of thinking about these objects is what they are is they have a trivial limit of the standard model. So hij in the case of the standard model at dimension 4, when you restrict yourself to d equals 4 interactions, these guys just turn into delta functions. When they're turning into delta functions, that's just the usual propagator for the scalar field and the things you could derive in terms of its interactions, the usual propagator for the Yang-Mills term. These W's are over 4 indices, A and B, because we're thinking about like a unified way of thinking of the Yang-Mills term. So there's 1, 2, 3, and then B here. And the reason we're thinking in terms of these sorts of objects is because these objects are useful in terms of the experimental observables, what we actually predict. Okay, so this is stuff that goes way back. There's usually stuff that goes way back in time. Here's some old literature related to some special cases. And this has been taking off in recent years phenomenology. So again, the analogy here is that, like in general relativity, where you have space-time coordinate general covariance, you start to think in terms of metrics and curvature tensors and these sorts of things. They're the useful mathematical objects because they have a well-defined transformation property. We're starting to think in terms of these field space metrics because these are the things that reflect the underlying field redefinition invariance in the field theory. Okay, is that clear as the basic point? Okay, good. Well, it's not just the W boson, it's also the B. So you'll see this in detail here. It's a unified Yang-Mills term. So one of these entries is B mu, and it also has cross terms of W mu, B mu. So we're thinking of the generalized things, which are the generalized structures of the theory that can be there when you have all these higher dimensional operators, because we're relaxing the D less than or equal 4 interaction. Yeah, we basically are writing down everything once we go beyond D equals 4. And so, you know, for example, this guy. In the case of the standard model, all you do is you write down and you have, you know, B mu. You don't write down anything like this because it would violate gauge invariance related to your question, the W mu, B mu term. But we're thinking about where we can have higher dimensional operators, where we can have scalar fields like H dagger, sigma A, H in front with the lambda squared to make up the mass dimensions. So there's nothing wrong with writing that down. It's just that you don't write it down because you're restricting yourself to like D less than or equal to 4. Now, if you think that beyond the standard model, where we use to like, you know, do the standard model to predict collider physics experiments, if you think there's something else, you know, other, which we don't know, you'd be completing the standard model and you integrate it out, it can induce these sorts of higher dimensional operators, where this will be a mass scale involved with some other physics that's integrated of the theory at some higher scale. Okay, so we're thinking of these generalized structures because they're capturing the low energy effects of physics beyond the standard model. Yeah.
So what's the justification for only including factors of phi and not say W squared?
Say again?
What's the justification for only looking at factors of phi and not say W squared?
Oh, well, we're going to, there's two different expansions involved, and the short answer to your question is it's very important to think about the case where you have phi as a function because the phi can take on a background field value, which is a constant, which is a VEV. That non-canonically normalizes things, so they have like a critical role in basically constructing S-matrix elements, as you'll see. You can think of other structures, too. We're going to get to that as well.
The concern is that the distinction between each schema is scheme dependent, so that in some scheme, what you call
in which scheme?
What you call phi squared, W squared in some scheme might mix up with W default in a different composition.
Oh, yeah. You have to worry about field redefinitions redefining the fields as well, right? And into one another in terms of a composite operator.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. So that's a subtlety which we're also going to get to, which I'll talk about. That's at the end of the talk. You've jumped to the end. So this is basically the starting point in terms of the analogy that we're going to exploit, OK? So hopefully that's clear. OK. So why are these things useful? These things are useful because once you have these things in your hands, you can start to think about calculating other geometric structures from them. Okay, these field-space interaction metrics, they allow you to calculate other aspects of geometry like Christoffel symbols and Riemann curvature tensors. And what actually happens in the amplitude perturbations, quite generally this statement is true, is you have a standard model amplitude and then you start to expand and what you do is you find some expectation value of some derivative parts of the operator forms you've written down with some metric structures. This will be like S or T or U are functions of kinematics. And you have coefficients. And those coefficients have to be basically defined by the geometric structures in the theory, because if you can actually isolate them and measure them experimentally, they have to reflect the underlying field redefinition invariance in the theory. Okay, so they have to be measurable. So they have to be an aspect of the physics which doesn't care about how you've chosen your field coordinate basis. So they have to be expressible in terms of field space geometries. So we're starting to find the pieces of the way to calculate, which lets us basically get to these objects more efficiently, is the reason this is useful. So let me show you a very simple example, which hopefully will make this clear. I think I should just start going this way. We'll see how far I get. Okay, so a very simple example of that point is just think about 2-to-2 scalar scattering, okay? And we'll have a Lagrangian, which is a simple one, which is just the simplest, we'll start with the simplest case. This can be a function of these scalars, but it'll be ungauged. It'll have a flavor index for the scalar fields, I and J. Okay, and we'll just think about this theory. This is an example that's simpler than the standard model EFT, it's just scalars. We're doing this scattering, and what do we get for this amplitude perturbation like I'm talking about? What you get is the amplitude is actually equal to the Riemann curvature tensor, which you derive from this. And then you get S with like I and, or K and L, and I, J, K, L, and you get an S, which is I, K. And these guys, the two index, is equal to like a PI plus a PJ all squared. So this is just a curvature structure, which you derive from this guy. And then it has these kinematics. So that's exactly this sort of thing being shown in this specific case. Now, if you're a clever experimentalist and if you can do this 2-to-2 scattering experiment, these things are kinematics. These are phase space positions for the related to the scattering states. So you can just choose your cuts to basically make S small, go to that region of the phase space. And you could kill off something like this. And then you can measure this. Or vice versa. And if that's the case, this thing should be something that's field redefinition invariant, isolatable in experiment. And that's exactly the case in how things organize themselves in terms of this thinking. Okay, this happens in this very simple case. If you work it out exactly, you'll find that's the case. And this looks trivial, but if you actually did this in terms of an operator language, and you hit like this guy and you wrote down this full expansion in terms of the two derivative stuff and all the higher dimensional operator stuff you could write down, it's a bit non-trivial that it organizes itself up into this form. But it has to because the field redefinition variance relates to different operator forms. Yeah?
You do something like Riemann-Nova coordinates or something.
We're right about to go there. Yes? That's exactly what I was about to say, actually. That's kind of like telegraphic. Awesome. So you, like literally, that was the next sentence. That's kind of cool. So the Riemann normal coordinates point, so what you can do to make this even clearer to yourself is you can indeed go to Riemann normal coordinates. And if you do go to Riemann normal coordinates, what you'll find is you can take hij, and the leading term is delta ij, the flat field space limit, and then you get minus a third rijkl, and then it's phi k phi l, and then this guy, when it multiplies the two open indices, gives you the expansion of this metric. Okay, so Riemann normal coordinates are essentially you set the Christoffels to zero by looking at the tangent space around the vacuum. So in the case of pure scalars, you can go to a special coordinate system, which makes it even clearer that that these sorts of structures should appear in terms of the scattering amplitudes. Okay? Good. All right, so hopefully that's very clear. So with that in hand, we're going to go a little bit further, and we're going to get a little more complicated and build towards the standard model EFT stuff. So this all follows, just so I don't have to write down the indices related to this point. If you have these metrics, of course, the usual way, calculate your Christoffel symbol, calculate the Riemann curvature tensor, it's all the same technology, just go through and everything goes through the same way. But these are now not space-time, they are field-space interaction Riemann curvature tensors and all these sorts of things. And again, you can indeed go to Riemann normal coordinates. Good.
So can you really write the whole metric as curvature?
Yeah. So this, for this particular simple case, you can. I just wrote down the first term. The next term is like a 6, and like you actually have this map, right? When the Riemann so in the pure scalar case, works fine. It's an interesting question if you can go to Riemann normal coordinates in general for all the background fields. That gets less clear because the geometries are more complex. But in the case of pure scalars, it does work, and you have a complete invertible map between the metric and an R and the function thereof. That's true. Okay, so we're going to get to understanding the standard model EFT stuff through essentially expanding out these guys and understanding what we're seeing in terms of the way we're calculating by brute force in a moment. But let me just step back so you understand the importance of the particular thing, which is the square root of the metric. Okay, I'm going to have to erase a bunch of stuff. Okay, so tetrads for fun and profit. So we were doing a lot of calculations for many years where we weren't thinking this way, and we were finding the results that when we look back on them now, they're very, very simple to develop if you think in the right way in terms of essentially this geometric approach. So how does that come about? So it's a very simple argument. So why should this, how should these metrics appear in terms of key things, which is going to be masses, LSE procedure, and couplings? Okay. So we're not going to look at couplings yet, but we're just going to look at masses and LSE in a pure scalar case. Can people see if I write here, or should I go that way? Should I go further back that way? Okay. So let's take this guy, and we're basically going to add a potential. So we add a potential. I'm going to have to keep this guy. So then we can just calculate the equation of motion for this very straightforwardly. And what you get is hij, a box, and then the potential with the one variation, one derivative of the potential, the other index contracted with phi j as a function of x, and the equation of motion has to equal 0. So if you want to go to canonically normalized external states and masses, then obviously you want to do something where you're going to diagonalize this metric. So a useful concept and useful set of things to think about is objects which do exactly that. They're called tetrads. And they are going to be when you, and this is going to be when you take the VEV. That's when you get the non-canonical normalization. So this guy you introduce, and then this guy, by definition, these tetrads, by definition, take you to canonically normalized external states. So what this tells you is that the square root of H. Was there a question?
Yeah. Is that a box, some fancy box, or is that just?
It's just a normal box.
How
do you get
class
of the HIJ? Oh, we just took the derivative here. There was an integration by parts, I think, as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Why didn't you get the HIJ? Like under phi,
the HIJ. Well, we take it to the VEV. So we take the HIJ and we evaluate at the VEV. So it's exactly the hij evaluated at the vacuum expectation value that the square root of it, essentially the inverse square root of it, is the key thing to think about. Yeah, so you take it to the external states. So yeah, that's V. And so the square root of this guy, evaluated at V, should be an important object in terms of canonically normalizing the fields, the masses, and the couplings. And that's exactly what we find when we do these brute force calculations. That's what these are in terms of the standard model EFT. So the ones again on the diagonal are the flat field space limit. And then what you have here are just perturbations, which are V squared over lambda squared, related to your question, times unknown Wilson coefficients. But these square roots of hij and square roots of gab are essential objects in terms of defining like what we actually measure in terms of experiment and actually defining our scattering amplitudes. Okay? So it's pretty much, yep.
Yeah, so this is only up to dimension 6 as a VFT, right?
As it's expanded, but you're going to see that we actually know these things at all order, which is why we have calculational power,
right,
which is another cool thing.
That's true.
So this is just the dimension 6 version.
Yeah, right.
So essentially what we did was we worked really hard doing things brute force, and then we figured out, oh, wait, we can do this brute force thing in this nice language of dimension 6. And then we realized, oh, wait, it's the general answer. And it goes to all orders. So that's essentially what happened historically. Always do the hard thing first. Anyways, but the external states you can label by some momentum with some index, and they're going to be essentially related to these guys as a function of x in this general case, with these tetrads should be obvious now. So ij, evaluate at the VEV, and then the usual momentum expansion, play wave momentum expansion. So you should expect these guys to also appear in how we define our scattering amplitudes in the LSE procedure. They should be key concepts as well, right? So that's exactly what happens. So we define an amplitude, and we have an overall momentum conserving delta function, and it's the product of exactly these guys with all the flavor labels that you need, p squared minus m squared. We pull off the external propagator in LSE, and then we have the limit. P squared goes to m squared, and we define our scattering amplitude. And then we get essentially our time order product of fields. So all of this stuff has come out of basically thinking in terms of EFTs, but I just want to emphasize this is kind of like just general understanding in terms of the way to calculate in these field theories, which is really all over the place. You can use it all over. And it's actually a very, very useful language because it lets you do stuff at all orders in the operator expansion all at once in terms of a very compact and useful notation. Okay, so let me show you how much we suffered a little bit before we figured out how to use this stuff. So this is an example of what we do by brute force. So what you do here is you basically start to say, well, if we find things in terms of perturbations from standard model predictions at LHC, how do they constrain some Wilson coefficients of higher dimensional operators? You think about things like this. You think about things like this. And this guy we talked about before, B mu nu. And you take this to a vacuum expectation value, so this becomes V squared times these things. You have non-canonically normalized vector fields. You figure out that you have to do a transformation of the gauge couplings to 1 plus, you know, CHW with the V squared over lambda squared to canonically normalize this one. You figure out you have to do a correlated transformation of the W fields in order to basically make it so that G2 times W doesn't change under this transformation. Just up to dimension 6. And we did this all by brute force right around the time of the Higgs discovery. And we did this for all the operators at dimension 6. And then you have to go to mass eigenstate fields and everything, and you get this mess, which is like the transformation from the weak to the mass eigenstates. You have to redefine the couplings with a particular operator form, which is this one, which causes all sorts of trouble, which used to be called the S parameter in terms of electric position data. You have this other aspect of the transformation. The masses get redefined and everything, and you figure out how the covariant derivative changes. And all the problems were proportional to the VEV. All this complication, all this mess. And this is just at dimension 6 in terms of interfacing with collider physics data. So you might want to wonder, how do you go to dimension 8? How do you do loops and these sorts of things? Things get more precise. But as I hope you're convinced, all of this is very simply understood just from this sort of language. and makes it much easier. So all that's going on at the end of the day is this, okay? The delta functions were the flat field space limit of the standard model. And that's why the transformation from weak to mass eigenstates in the case of the standard model was just called a rotation, because it really was. This rotation matrices were appearing here, the indices were contracted, and it was a simplification due to flat field spaces. But as you saw, when you have these general functions around, it's the square roots of the metrics evaluated at the BEV that actually show up. And that's exactly what happens, which we figured out a couple of years ago after we did the hard stuff. And we figured this out because we wanted to go beyond dimension six. This is the only way to really do it. There are a lot of mistakes in the literature of trying to do that, and this basically cleaned it up. And then basically we knew what to do. So if you look at this, all of this stuff which looks complicated was really complicated because it's very much like you're describing a curve in a fundamentally Cartesian coordinate system. So you get correlated projectors all over the place of the Wilson coefficient dependence. You describe that curve in, you know, polar coordinates, it's much simpler. And that's basically what we're thinking, is these geometries are the spaces that are actually around. Yeah?
Yeah, just precise, there's actually, I actually did all of these in dimension 8 recently, and then I used your paper.
Yep.
Confirmed.
Hopefully it's right.
No, but I mean, there has been, I just wanted to see, it has been worked out up to dimension 8.
Yeah.
And then
so if there were some mistakes in the literature, which we fixed by doing this, but you should find it's correct at all orders.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
It was kind of a double check too.
I'm glad. Yeah. So if we're wrong, tell us. But this, you know, it should be the case.
I remember this.
Yeah. But it's horrible, right? I mean, you suffered too. I mean, it's really bad if you don't do it with the good language. So, but anyways. All right. So this, once we gauge the theory, I'll get to this point in a second. Okay. So we need to gauge the theory now. So we're going to go beyond now this Hij, which is just a simple scalar case, and add gauging. So we tick our GABs here, and we add a potential, and we make these covariant derivatives, right? Very straightforward. And then this generalized WAB, and then this guy evaluated the potential. So the gauging is quite straightforward. It's just adding the covariant derivative. What's a little bit interesting about it is that it introduces kind of a nice way of thinking about the representations for the Higgs field. And it's basically this guy. So you write down this object, which is a function of the scalars. And it's a killing vector for this, these spaces. And what is this? This is exactly hopefully I got my indices correctly. This is exactly what I called this vertex here, this generator, with phi j. So what you do to figure these guys out is you basically take the scalar field representation of the standard model we usually use, H, you hit it with the Pauli matrices, and you see how H transforms in terms of real scalar field coordinates. So you write H in terms of phi, you know, 3 plus I, phi, 4, phi 1 plus I, phi 2. How it transforms is pretty straightforward to figure it out, and you figure out the corresponding four-dimensional transformation for the real scalar field coordinates, and you absorb the gauge indices in there. That's all that is. But it's kind of a nice object, as you'll see in the field theory, in terms of the Lie derivatives, and you start to think in terms of real scalar field coordinates when you start to do this. And it's just a nice way of unifying the treatment of the Pauli matrices with the embedding of the B field, because we want to think in terms of these unified Yang-Mills guys, which also run over Bs, where you have this also around. So it's a nice way of combining these guys up into a set of generators. Yep.
Why don't you have higher polynomials in phi?
Why don't I have...
Why is the
vector field linear?
Which vector field?
The healing vector.
Oh, this guy?
Yes.
It's just linear in this phi. Yeah.
But if you're doing the definitions of phi, polynomials, wouldn't that also become?
Yeah, so this is just by mass dimension, it's just fixed by this guy here. But you can do field redefinitions on phi as well. But that's built into this formalism that you can do these field redefinitions. But there is always a linear phi around, which you can use to contract up to construct this object.
I see, so you said
we do have a fixed coordinate system in the sense of, like, we have a phi. You have the freedom to redefine phi, which introduces these other objects, but there's always a phi. That's linear order, which contracts in this way to define this object.
The technomization scheme, it's a sort of gauge fixing.
No, we'll get to the gauge fixing, but it's just essentially that you are going to have, by mass dimension, a mass dimension one object there, which is going to be your field phi. It'll take on a VEV as well, which will give masses to the vector fields, but it does exist. There's always a phi that exists in whatever coordinate system you choose at linear order. But we do have the freedom to redefine phi. That's true. I mean, you can write down higher order things, obviously.
Yes.
That's true. This was just limited by the mass dimensions of this guy. Right? So there's also higher order objects. This is always a plus dot dot.
But you could have coefficients.
There's always a plus dot dot.
You could have coefficients in there, too.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, you could call them interactions. But
yeah, yeah. No, but we that's true. But there's always a plus dot dot in this discussion, which these higher order interactions are also around. Yeah, but we're just talking about the lower order ones in mass dimension. The reason we're talking about the lower order mass dimension ones is because they define things that are related to experimental measurements, right? Like the masses, the couplings, the resonance structures, which dictate the experimental measurements that we do. So when we restrict ourselves to low endpoint interactions, which this one generates a lot of low endpoint interactions, it's useful phenomenologically. But there's always the higher order ones as well.
But you're allowing all powers of phi in H.
Yeah, yeah. So that's right. Well, I mean, again, I think I've answered. It's just that there's the mass dimension of the left-hand side of the equation is equaling the right-hand side of the equation.
Like
it's just the object of this guy, right?
The left-hand also is a mass dimension, right?
Sure.
So in H, you put numbers which are dimensionful. So the coefficients in T, pi squared in T, there will be coefficient that is dimensionful.
So there are higher-order interactions, which I think is partially what you're asking about. Yeah.
I just wonder if it would be useful to incorporate some of them into T, just because if I talk about the manifold,
there's questions of that which we're going to get to hopefully by the end with respect to the general geometries that we're dealing with. But this is a particular choice of thinking about the geometries and thinking about the coordinatization of the scalars around some fixed derivative expansion. So we have made a choice here in terms of doing a fixed derivative expansion and then scalar dressings thereof. But we can do more general things, which I'm going to try and get to at the end. That's one of the open questions, is how to think about those more general geometries. OK. So hopefully this was clear. This is just a set of matrices that is associated with this Killing vector. And it's kind of an interesting beast, this guy. Wow, there's no chance I'm going to get through all the things I want to get through. But we'll see how far I get. So
can you maybe like how you're able to
it's resonance domination, fundamentally, at the end of the day. So most of the things that we measure are things where we basically have to have some measurement which populates phase space above some background. Whenever we have a phase space population above a background, like for example, in terms of Lep scattering, which you'll see in a second, you basically have to have a resonance structure which populates phase space much more than the background scattering events. And so because of that basic fact, then the things that dictate the low endpoint functions, which dictate the resonance structures, are the things you have the most sensitivity for experimentally. Of course, here, you also can write down something like this, a higher dimensional operator like you're asking about. And this could have arbitrary numbers of derivatives and that sort of thing. And you might say, well, how is this suppressed compared to this? And it is suppressed compared to this because the resonance population of phase space is dictated by a ratio, which is the width of the standard model divided by the masses. And this is small, so that inverse of that ratio pumps up the phase space population of all the low endpoint function stuff in the field theory. So that's why we can actually resolve these sorts of things and why we're dictated by low endpoint interactions.
I don't care about that.
So maybe that was. Well, I just mean resonance structure. We basically want to build resonances. Let me just make the answer to that. So if we want to build resonances, the resonances come from the low endpoint 2 and 3 point interactions of the field theory. And I can, so that's essentially why we have experimental resolution on that.
So somewhere in this discussion was the splice times my splices of low energy.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. We're going further, but we're going further step by step, hopefully. Okay, so when you have this guy around, you can actually construct a Lie algebra for it, or a Lie derivative for it. So you can have this guy. So it's equal to 0. And that's actually structurally similar to how this acts, this generator acts on the other metric that we have around. So it's like this in terms of its algebra. Oh, this is a D. Let me know if I get one of my indices wrong. D. So these equations are structurally similar. So you might want to start to think about another structure in the theory, which is like, well, maybe we should be starting to think about combining this object and this object, right? Because why should we just stick with, field redefinitions can move things around. Why should we just stick with this term separated out from this term, right? So people have asked that question and tried to think about doing that sort of thing. And that's something we're going to get to in a moment. But if we just stick with this characterization of things, we just have these metrics around, you can see that the square roots of those metrics are kind of essential, as we saw. And with the gauging, we now have masses, and we now have the couplings. So what you should expect to happen is you should expect, when you write down the covariant derivatives, that the square roots of these metrics should appear redefining the gauge couplings. They should appear in the masses, in terms of the expressions. And basically, you should expect that the mixing angles should possibly be redefined as well in terms of these square roots of these metrics evaluated at the VEV. That's exactly what happens. And all this stuff is, you know, basically just by figuring out an asymptotic state that's a mass eigenstate field. And then you have this language that packs up all the higher dimensional operators. And this is basically the answer at all orders in the expansion of V over lambda in terms of how these redefinitions come about. Okay. So, related to your question, this would not be terribly useful if we didn't have these expressions, these guys, known in closed form. So there's another nice little mathematical fact that it happens here, which lets us basically write these down in closed form. So you might say to yourself, well, they're arbitrarily complicated functions. It's just notation, right? So we can't actually write them down. And so can you actually calculate with them beyond dimension 6? But these are the answers with equal signs. And why can you actually write these guys down? Why is it that they don't have an arbitrarily complicated structure? What's happening is that you have essentially a scalar field. And you can take a scalar field. You're dressing these functions. And you can have symmetry generators, potentially, inserted. You can have phi n, phi m, and you can have another symmetry generator you can insert, and other scalar fields. But the point is, at the end of the day, as you go up an operator mass dimension, you're asking yourself the question, if I contract all of these internal indices with all possible symmetry generator insertions, and I only have two external indices, which is just I and j, how many contractions can I do? So if there were no symmetry generators around, you would think that there weren't a lot of different ways to do these contractions, right? Essentially, at the end of the day, you would just get phi's internally contracted with phi's internally. You should just have phi squareds. So you just have whatever you have at leading order, and then phi squared or h dagger h towers on top of that. When you have these generators around, you would think that it's arbitrarily complicated, but it's not, because the completeness relations of the generators reduce to delta functions. And that's why that at the end of the day, you can write these down in closed form, and they're actually not complicated. We actually know the answer, and these are the closed form answers for these two important objects. So that gives us calculational power combined with basically the way we canonically normalize things in terms of this geometry at the get-go, just by looking at the canonical normalization. Yep?
It is the statement that if I plot the metric depends on SU2.
I didn't hear what you said. Say it again.
It is the statement that if I plot the metric depends on SU2, is invariant. It only depends on the radius.
It's similar.
Intuitively.
It is true that the transformations of the net transformations of the phi with those two indices, it's following from the fact that you have a fundamental SUN around. But the only gauge invariant structure is once you contract the indices across the other terms, right? Those are open indices. So I think it's just really a contraction fact. I don't think it's necessarily SU2 symmetry, other than SU2 symmetry gives you the generator reduction formula of this form, if that's what you're saying.
I'm assuming that's the most general matrix.
No, this is just the generator of SUN, the SU2 in the case of the Higgs.
Yes. So this is the most general SU2.
So in the sense, this is the symmetry reduction that you're talking about, and that does happen to simplify this. So that's, in a sense, the answer to your question with a yes. Because if those generators didn't have this reduction, then you wouldn't have the simplification. You would have arbitrary numbers of contractions. It would go fractorially in terms of the complexity, as opposed to it being constant in terms of the complexity once you basically hit around mass dimension 8. So I think yes is the short answer to your question. Yeah?
Yeah, so am I correct to assume, so the last identity is what we call a Phi's transformation in color space, I mean, for SU3.
You can call it that if you wish, but this is SUN. But
SUN in general.
Yeah. But it's basically just you're reducing it to delta functions. So that's what gives you these closed form answers. And it doesn't just give it to these two metrics. It gives you to any of these objects that are functions of the scalar field you could write down in your way you're characterizing this physics. Okay, so that's why you have calculational power also thinking this way in terms of scalar dressings. Okay, right. Good. So related to what you were asking earlier, this is what I was alluding to. So once we have in our hands masses, couplings, canonical normalization, we can basically, in the three-point functions and two-point functions, the propagators, we can calculate a lot, almost everything we need in terms of collider physics data that gets precise. So here's a nice example just to illustrate the power of this to you. So Lepp, you remember, went through the Z peak, and it just scanned, and it basically measured the properties of the Z around the Z resonance. And you can characterize that scan through the Z peak as a function of widths, masses, and combinations, ratios of widths. So if you have the ability to calculate three-point functions and two-point functions at all orders in this expansion, you can calculate this sort of thing and calculate, expand out the decay widths, and you can basically interpret the data at dimension 6 or dimension 8 or dimension 10 in closed form. And you just know the answer. So that's exactly what you can do. This sort of expansion is now known with this sort of stuff. And the masses have nicely the tetrads appearing here. And we know all the couplings, and you just saw that. So after we actually developed this formalism, this allowed us to calculate electric precision data for the first time. People couldn't figure out how to formulate this calculation for decades. And with this in hand, we could do it in 3 weeks. That really is what happened. So this gives you an idea of the power of the formalism that has been developed here in terms of what you can actually calculate. So it's kind of nice that actually lets you do that. And that was a nice thing that popped right out of it. OK, so we're going to get to gauging now. OK. Oh boy. See if I get there. So, right. So getting back to this point in terms of these two transformation, these two Lie algebra equations, you might want to think in terms of this unified metric that I was mentioning. You might want to try and combine this and this to go further to have a unified version of this sort of description. So this question has been asked. So recently, people have said, can we actually do this combination? Can we think in terms of this object? And then GAB, and then, so this is a paper by Andreas Helstedt, Anish Manohar, and friends. And what they do is they take this sort of metrics which they introduce, they kind of close their eyes a little bit for the fact that these are spin one, and these are spin, you know, these are spin zero fields. But you can still calculate the Riemann curvature tensor that comes from it. You can still calculate Christoffel symbols defining such a beast, and just see what happens in terms of scattering experiments. You can just compare against this, against the results you get with operator calculations. And what you find, you also have to think in terms of a unified generator, which is this guy. Oh, I don't want to erase these. So I'll leave this. So you have to think in terms of this generator structure combined up. So you have to take the one that was for the scalars, and you have to introduce one for the vector fields, basically absorbing some indices. And what this guy is delta AB derivative, and then the usual A, B, C. So this is the usual, you know, transformation property on the gauge field itself. You basically define this guy absorbing some indices. This is sort of the unified generator you think of, and then you get a unified version of this Lie derivative equation, and you start to think in terms of this unified space that you're putting together these two metrics. Okay, so why would you do such madness? Why would you possibly think that that's a useful thing to do? It's again because we're talking about scattering experiments, and we have things like this do the higher dimensional operators. We have gauge scalar connections around, and so we have Riemann curvatures around like this that actually do come out of that formalism, which you can calculate correctly, not just at like leading order, but higher orders thinking this way. So this is why these people are motivated to do this sort of thing, and that's why they're going in that sort of direction. Well, that was kind of supposed to be the first point, yeah. Which is that that's actually what appears in the scattering amplitudes, because the scattering amplitudes, they do reflect the fact that you have field redefinition invariance in terms of the way you describe the physics and the way you formulate things. So you can calculate. So what we usually do for decades is we basically write down a Lagrangian, we put higher dimensional operators down. We use field redefinitions because we have field redefinition freedom to fix an operator basis. We calculate in a fixed operator basis, and then we calculate some observables, and magically what happens is we get combinations of operators once we get to the observable level, which are field redefinition invariant structures. Yeah, so that sense, but you can do that. That's what people do for decades. People continue to do that. But what happens is you can realize the field redefinition invariance means you should think in terms of these objects, which are these describing these geometric spaces, field spaces which are around, and reflect the field redefinition invariance in the notation and like really in the construction. And then you can calculate directly with them. And when you do that, the benefit is not just that you get the dimension six results that you can calculate by hand and brute force. You actually get all orders results. You get like everything, the whole tower of effects, you get it all at once. So it's just a much more efficient way to calculate. And people are able to calculate things that they can't calculate with the usual operator language thinking this way. Like you get into technical difficulties once you go to higher orders in the operator expansion that you avoid doing this sort of thinking. Yeah?
So how do the mixed terms you want to add look like?
Sorry?
How do the mixed terms between the phi and a and w look like?
You mean the off diagonals?
Yes.
Ah, that's a very good question. We're supposed to get to that at the end. So this is a choice here. You're just doing a block diagonal structure.
It's not like the mu phi in w mu.
Yeah. So the higher derivative stuff, and that's related to your other question about the derivative field redefinitions. Let me answer. So that those off diagonals, you could try and think about those off diagonals in terms of related to derivative field redefinitions as well. So this is just a choice of an object that you write down trying to combine things up. People really are not sure what the right set of geometric objects to think about are. They're following their nose. With this choice, you can calculate things like this and other things I'll show you in terms of what comes out of the divergence structure of the theory. So it's a manifestly useful choice in terms of some results. But it's not necessarily a unique choice. And we're not actually sure what the optimal way to think about this geometry is at all.
Because if you put quadratic and higher terms in T,
No, that we can have off-diagonal terms and off-diagonal structures. This is just a choice. It's not the only choice of way of describing this geometry. You're correct. Yeah, you can make other choices. But I'll show you what happens when you make these choices. Okay? So, with this, going to this other sort of generator structure and trying to construct these sorts of objects, you can actually calculate divergences in the theory for higher order that no one could calculate before. So let me just try and get you to that. But I have to step back a little bit and talk about the background field method, and I will finish on time, even though I'm not going to get to what I want to do. I saw that. Yeah, we can talk after, but I'm going to let everybody else go. So divergences of the theory, okay? So why are people doing this? Why are people doing this sort of combined construction? Why is this an active area of research? Well, they want to basically be able to calculate things like this, because this actually relates to scattering experiment results that they can actually measure in the future. Okay, so they want to understand the divergence structure of the theory. They want to understand how to calculate this sort of thing.
I don't
yep.
So scattering between the base part.
Say again.
Certain scattering between each.
I didn't hear what you said again.
What scattering?
Oh.
It's between the four each field.
Yeah. So this would be like far into the future. Vector boson fusion die Higgs. Turn it around. So potential, that's a long-term future. But people would like to be able to calculate this sort of thing. You can actually measure these sorts of things once they decay. This is actually the case. All right, so let me talk about the background field method and gauge fixing for a moment, because it's related to the calculation these people are doing, and they're trying to figure out what's going on in this more complicated metric. So the thing something that Tuff figured out, very importantly, in the 70s, was if we background field gauge fix, just to remind you, if you gauge fix the theory and you just make a gauge fixing term, you break the gauge invariance for intermediate steps of the calculation, the answer at the end of the day reflects gauge invariance. There's a smarter way of gauge fixing, which is the background field method. You double the fields, you have classical background fields you don't break the gauge invariance of, you add to that a fluctuation, which you then gauge fix, okay? You can add in the electroweak standard model this gauge fixing term. And what's nice about this, once you go to mass eigenstates, this is just how it's constructed. The hats here are the background fields. Is that what comes out of this, which is nice, is that you basically get symmetry relationships between endpoint functions and different observables, which is like consistent with your naive classical expectation of what should actually be the relationships between observables when you actually have the symmetry structure of the theory. So you don't break intermediate steps of the calculation, the symmetry relations. So this is actually something that you would want to say, well, how do we background field gauge fix if we're going to have these metrics around, right? We saw that these metrics are redefining the mass eigenstate fields and redefining everything. So how does that actually happen? So there was a problem that we found many years ago related to this. It was actually one of the things which actually started us thinking in this way. You use the usual background field method, and you basically gauge fix the theory, and you put higher dimensional operators in, but then you change the relationship between the mass and the weak eigenstate fields in the way that I showed you. But what was a consequence of that was we didn't get the Ward identities that we expected in the calculation because we weren't thinking in terms of the correct transformed field variables from weak to mass eigenstates involving the higher dimensional operator perturbations. So what you can do, and what you should probably think is the obvious thing to do now, is if you want to take Tuff's result and generalize and gauge fix on these curved background field spaces, what you should do is just basically insert metrics, square roots of metrics, and square roots of metrics squared everywhere you can to generalize his gauge fixing. So you basically write the metric that you can to contract these indices. This is your gauge fixing term. This is this generator that we talked about for the real scalar fields. This is the other metric that was around. And this is the thing you write down, just contracting the indices for the gauge fixing term. Now, from that, you basically construct your effective action. And out of that, you get nice Ward identities, and you get nice aspects of the calculation that let you check things, let you go to higher order in the perturbative expansion of the theory when you have the higher dimensional operators around. OK, so that's old news. But just again to remind you, that's basically how to gauge fix when you have all this sort of stuff around. If you just think about it in terms of operators, all this is around is being packed up in this notation. It's appearing here, and so on and so forth. This is being packed up and appearing here. These are the generators. And it's just a nice gauge fixing result, which lets us calculate even things at two loop order a couple weeks ago. Good.
So this is the exact one. So you need a new boosting. These are the instant calculus boosting supergraph.
Say again.
This is the determinant term.
Yeah.
Because of the trimetric and gauge fixing.
Yeah.
So you have any channel ghost.
Oh, no, the ghost, we derive the ghost interactions as well. They follow directly. Well, maybe. Yeah, it might be. I don't know that, but it might be. But we derived the ghost interactions as well, and we've done these calculations involving the ghost fields, and everything works in terms of the one-loop calculations of the theory with higher-dimensional operator insertions. So we can talk about that. I need to finish on time. We can talk about that in a moment. Let me get to the point. I just want to get to one point. So this is the gauge fixing that was done, and it's actually underlying a lot of the calculations people are doing in terms of interfacing with the data for low energy data and Higgs data and LEP data. This is letting one loop calculations involving these higher dimensional operators appearing and being used. And it got rid of a problem, which is this problem. So when you actually have Tuff's gauge fixing procedure, it's designed to kill off this contact operator of the A mixing with the Z, because that shouldn't happen in terms of, you know, the naive expectation of the theory at one loop. If you just do normal gauge fixing, that gets induced at one loop, and you have to do a normalization condition to get rid of it. But Tuff's gauge fixing is amazing because you choose XCW equals XZB, and it kills this term for you. But when you have the higher dimensional operators around, because the way you're redefining everything, it's back, and you can't get rid of it with XCB equals XCW. And this confused us when we met this many years ago. But when you do this gauge fixing procedure I just showed you, it exactly kills this. Everything's working as expected in the case of the theory. So then you think you can actually go to higher orders. So you get nice Ward identities, I want to finish on time, that come out of the background field gauge invariants of the theory. And some very nice aspects of the calculational results then appear where the tetrads combine up to give you the masses and the Ward identities as you expect. And everything works at one loop with the higher dimensional operator insertions around. Otherwise, we were getting quite confused in the community as like what's going on when people are trying to check their calculations looking at the Ward identities. They were not actually working as expected when the higher dimensional operators were around. Okay, so that's all fine. Now, the thing that people are doing here, and I'll just mention this and I'll stop because it gets into like what people are doing now. What people are doing here in terms of trying to do this combined metric, why are they doing this? They're doing this because they want to think about calculating things like this and Riemann curvature tensors and higher dimensional operators and the divergent structures of the theory. So what you need to do is you need to take the gauge fixing in the background field method, use these generalized metrics, modify the gauge fixing procedure one way or another with these generalized metrics, and then calculate the second order fluctuation of the action. This is all results from this paper of Helsid, Jenkins, and Manohar of this fall. It's a complicated mess. I'm just showing you the results. You don't have to follow the indices. But the point is to calculate the second order fluctuation in the background fields. If you calculate the second order fluctuation in the background fields, again, going back to Tuft in 73, then you actually have the ability to calculate the divergence structure of the theory, which is, erase something. If you actually have the second order fluctuation of the action in the background fields, then the divergence structure of the theory is basically given by this. It's a nice closed form answer to have figured out. And it's 1/12 the trace of y mu nu plus 1/2 the trace of x squared, where these objects in Tuft's case are just basically defined by the leading order renormalizable Lagrangian. And once you start to do these generalized metrics with this generalized geometric approach, you can still do the same calculation Tuft did. You have the structure of the theory, the counterterms have to appear consistent with what you wrote down in terms of the background fields. So you have to basically get out of that renormalization of the geometric structure of the theory as well. And so you essentially get definitions of this guy that in the case of the scalars, I'll just give you one example of this, is geometric. This is something Anish figured out with collaborators. So you get like this sort of thing, the geometric generalization of Tuft's result. And it's all written in terms of the geometries which are present in the theory. This is again the potential with two derivatives. And the other object is also defined geometrically as well. So that should lead you to immediately ask the question, I'm about to finish, that what about running of these geometric structures in the field theory themselves? Can we actually think about their running equations? Can we actually basically start to think about their divergent structure? And that's actually the case. So what they also did, which is really cool, is they, well, there's a technical modification of the gauge fixing term, which had to happen, which I don't want to get into. But the point is you can end up getting running equations for these objects in the field theory themselves. Not the running of operators, but the running of the curvature tensor or covariant derivatives of the metric structures themselves. Okay? So these objects are the objects that appear in the field theory, and we're learning with this sort of thinking how to actually renormalize and think directly in terms of these objects in terms of doing perturbative calculations. And they have built into them a whole higher dimensional operator expansion. So this is very strong calculational power in terms of interfacing with experimental results. I'm not going to go over, even though I wanted to say a lot more. I'm going to stop there.
So that's
yeah.
And then following the suggestion, we'll do like questions now and ready questions.
Sure. Anyone who wants to run can run. But we can talk more after as well.
So I'm a bit confused because usually the covariant derivative of a metric is zero. So
oh, this is the variation with respect to the background VEV.
Oh,
so there's a notation going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't have time to explain all of that. But this is the variation with respect to the background VEV fluctuation. Yeah. And actually, since we have a second, I'll just let me show you one thing that's super cool. So this stuff we're figuring out the running of and figuring out how to calculate with perturbatively is exactly what appears in the experimental result. Like, here is an example of glue Higgs production. It's written in terms of kinematics, a variation of a metric, and then a tetrad, as you would expect considering what I told you earlier. This is the same thing for Higgs to gamma-gamma, and this is at all orders in V over lambda. It's again a tetrad, a variation of a metric, and then you have to go to mass eigenstates, so that's why these geometrically redefined couplings are around. That stuff can all be written in an even more compact and nice way with helicity variables in just, It's just this, which is one of these things that people are figuring out the running of. So it's just the background field variation of GAB with basically spinner variables for PA and PB for the labeled external states. Let me make sure I write this equation down correctly. Right, there's a half. So this is the amplitude for Higgs to glue at all orders in V over lambda in a particular helicity configuration. And this is just AB squared. This is the kinematics that you saw, which I got rid of. And this is just this variation with respect to the background field. And then you rotate to mass eigenstates. And this is all Higgs to two vector interactions at all orders in V over lambda being written down. And we're starting to figure out how these things actually run, the divergence structure theory related to this. So it's really interesting, actually, what's going on here in terms of all the ways we're basically packing apart the way we calculate in the field theory and figuring out better ways to think about it. Yeah?
Yeah. So that slide you just had.
Which one? Can you say which one? This one?
The very last thing.
This one?
Yeah, that thing.
Yeah, I didn't get to that.
So I'm just wondering, is there a generalization of this to fermions? I'm assuming the answer is yes, based on what I see. But you
so didn't. We didn't have time to get into that, but we can go as long as you want. So the thing is, the general argument I gave you in terms of field space geometry is a general argument. And it should allow us to formulate the field theory in all the endpoint interactions. But there's technical barriers to going to like higher endpoint interactions, and fermions are a challenge. But what you can do is with fixed fermion fields, you can figure out all 2 and 3 point interactions that you need to calculate anything you want in the whole V over lambda expansion. And you figure out this is the set of things you need to do with like scalar dressing functions. And it's a closed form. It's a small subset of things. And the fermion connections are here. Okay, so if you wanted to calculate LEP data like I showed you, this term is actually the Christoffel that combines up in the field space invariant way with the usual thing that you would do is just the tetrad redefine psi bar I d slash psi. So this term you add to this guy, it's really the Christoffel that makes it manifest a field redefinition invariant, and that's part of how we're able to do the LEP calculation. So the fermions are there. If you want to go beyond 4 points and higher endpoint functions in terms of this geometric language, that's where people are struggling, but they're struggling for various reasons which aren't fundamental. Field redefinition invariance is around. It's just people aren't sure of how to do certain math steps that we were able to do for low endpoint interactions, because momentum conservation is trivial when you go to 3 points and below. And so that actually leads to a lot of simplification, which isn't present for higher endpoint interactions. But there's nothing fundamentally in the way in terms of trying to generalize it. Just people don't know how to do it yet.
So in part.
It's people are thinking about it, but we have an fixed expansion around fermion fields. And you can just write down higher order operators as well and figure out how to pack them up. I mean, you know, but that's an active area of research. People are not actually sure how to do that yet. Yeah.
You can't tell me that including all gradient corrections.
I didn't hear what you said.
Including all gradient corrections.
We're working on that.
I presume you can agree with experimental.
So using these techniques, we can calculate things like there was a paper we put out a couple weeks ago where we're doing like two loop calculations for Higgs to glue, which also have higher dimensional operators like dimension 8, dimension 6 squared stuff. So these are like the leading calculations of the perturbations from the standard model predictions that can be put forth in terms of interfacing with experimental result. And yes, we do agree with these techniques, with the standard model usual cases. We actually use those to build the perturbations that we're doing.
You see the Fermi measure, which is 7 sigma 5 hertz.
Sorry, which one? Which measurement?
Mu CDF measurement.
Of what?
Seven sigma.
Of what, though?
The Atlas Clade that I've reanalyzed.
But I'm not sure which measurement you're referring to.
There's no use term.
I think he's referring to the reanalysis of CDF and the W mass.
Oh, the W mass?
I think.
Yeah. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, so the W mass we've interpreted in terms of the usual SMEFT approach, just dimension six operators. That's been done, and that's been done a long time ago. You can do that reinterpretation at arbitrarily high orders in the operator expansion with these techniques, and that can just be done. But I mean, I think that the W mass measurement probably, because other measurements of Atlas came closer to the standard model that happened since with their reanalysis. These are very difficult measurements to compare because the PDFs are different in the two experiments. But I think that it's likely that the W mass anomaly is likely some combination of underestimation of radiative corrections and some coding issues in terms of that analysis of the data. Yeah.
Actually, related to that, since it's talking about the data, does this approach have anything to say in terms of the anomalous magnetic moment of the muon, which is still there?
Not yet. No, I don't think so. No. People have not applied it for that.
Sorry?
People have not applied it to that.
Okay.
I mean, people have done so what people have done, like I said, is for decades, they just do the operator thing, the dimension six operator thing, and that's been done for the anomalous magnetic moment of a muon. If you wanted to calculate that at higher orders and like interpret that carefully, these techniques will help you because they underlie the matching of the standard model EFT with all the higher dimensional operator perturbations onto the low energy experiment that is. That's actually how the one loop calculations with the operators were done, is using these techniques. So they're underlying some of those interpretations already. And if you wanted to push the precision of that interpretation, you can do this and do it the easier way, or you can do it the hard way. You can always go back to operators and just brute force calculate if you want. But it's a much harder way to do things. No, well, I mean, if it's underlying some of the results that have been used in that analysis.
Okay.
Yeah. In particular, the matching at one loop between the standard model EFT and what's called the LEFT, the low energy effective theory, integrating with the Higgs, the top, the W, and the Z, that used these techniques. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that kind of brings me to my question. How exactly are you getting into the amplitude supermode without sort of incorporating some sort of
Well, it wasn't discussed here. It was discussed a couple weeks ago. So in the case of the top, if you go to the heavy top limit, that is the low energy contact operator. And you can actually reuse a lot of the two loop amplitude results in the standard approach, which came out of Babis and friends. Those results are known in closed form. And the problem with using those results, which we overcame a couple weeks ago, was you probably noticed, even though it was probably too quickly said, the background field method is critical for what we're doing here and all the stuff that we're doing in terms of the way we're formulating this physics. Babis's results were not, even though they're given intermediate steps which we wanted to use for two-loop glue-glue Higgs production, they were not in the background field method. So we had to like modify what was going on in the background field method, but then once we did that, we were able to use his results to get a two-loop answer consistent with known results in the case of the standard model, but get, for the first time, the EFT perturbations at higher order with all the higher order stuff. Other questions? I have a lot of other stuff I was going to say, but I don't want to abuse your time. If everyone wants to run, we can talk about some of the other stuff if you'd like. Yeah, it's kind of the second half. If anyone's interested, I'm happy to go for it. But.